Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Prepare your ears, humans. Happy, Sad, Confused begins now.
Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, Bo Burnham, from stand-up comedy to becoming a filmmaker with Eighth Grade to a starring role in Promising Young Woman. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. Welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Happy New Year, guys. Welcome to 2021. We made it. The darkness is behind us. Maybe some darkness ahead. There's always darkness ahead, but more light than dark. Let's all hope and pray and make it happen. Think positive thoughts as we begin this new year. We're starting off with a fun one. Bo Burnham, first-time guest on Happy, Sad, Confused. You know him for his fantastic comedy, his comedy specials. That's sort of where he made his name and on YouTube. And then, of course, with Eighth Grade a couple years back, he wrote and directed that fantastic film starring Elsie Fisher. I love that movie. I got to know Bo a little bit on that silly awards circuit. He's hard to miss in a crowd, by the way. He's like 9 feet tall, so, and he's like younger than every other awards nominee, so he was easy to gravitate towards in that year. And I was thrilled to catch up with him again. Actually, twice in the last year, because I saw him early in the year at Sundance when Promising Young Woman debuted, caught up with him and Carey Mulligan, who is the true centerpiece, by the way. She is the Promising Young Woman at the center of that film. But Bo has a sizable, he has the leading male role, so good for him. And anyway, I got a chance to catch up with them about that film, and that was a real treat because it really was maybe my favorite film of Sundance, and one of, frankly, my favorite films of 2020. I didn't do the top 10 list. Maybe I still will. I'm feeling the peer pressure. We'll see. But it's one of the best films of the last year. A great bit of satire, comedy, black comedy, drama. It's got a little bit of everything. It is definitely its own beast. Very much, I would think if you're going to compare it to anything, I think of the great Gus Van Sant film To Die For, if you remember that film with Nicole Kidman. I don't want to say too much about the premise because it's got a lot of twists and turns, but Carey Mulligan basically plays a woman who has been wronged and who feels wronged and is out for revenge against men who have taken advantage of her and other women in her life. And yeah, it goes to some dark, unexpected places, but it is thoroughly entertaining from start to finish. Go in and enjoy everything that Promising Young Woman has to offer, including a great performance from Bo Burnham. Good for Bo, who not only, you know, has the chops as a stand-up comedian, clearly, and as a filmmaker, but holds his own against Carey Mulligan, who may be the best actor working today. So that's quite an achievement for Bo, and I'm thrilled that it gave us an opportunity to catch up after nearly a year apart. And Bo is nothing if not frank and honest and funny about what this last year has been for him. You know, it's been difficult for him, like it's been difficult for most, if not all of us. So I always welcome that kind of honesty, especially from somebody as smart and funny as Bo. So I think you guys are going to enjoy this conversation. It's our first, really kicking off 2021 in style. So very happy about that. Other quick things to mention. Stir Crazy. Yes, we've taken a couple weeks off from Stir Crazy on Comedy Central, but fear not, we are back next week, and the guest, I am pleased to say, is the fantastic former guest of Happy, Sad, Confused, Jane Levy, currently starring, of course, on Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist, back for season 2 on NBC. Support that show. It's a great piece of work, and Jane is always fun, and she delivered on this episode of Stir Crazy. That's on next week's episode. Seek it out on Comedy Central's Facebook and YouTube pages. One more thank you I want to mention. We did a special Happy, Sad, Confused benefit at the end of 2020. It was just for the folks that bought tickets to the Symphony Space event. No, it will not appear as a podcast. And part of that, the reason for that, guys, I hope you understand, is the whole objective of that was to make some money for some good charities. And we did. We succeeded. So good on you guys. And I have to make it special for the folks that came out for that live event. Don't worry, Katrina will be back on the podcast. Of course she will. Of course we'll do silly things. Of course she'll do Stir Crazy at some point. She is part of the Josh Horowitz friends and family collective, so don't worry. But for those of you that did come out, 2,000 plus of you for that live event, what a joy, what a thrilling way to end 2020 and raise some money for some good causes. So my heartfelt thanks to all of you. I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed hosting it. I guess that's all I want to say, except to say I hope you guys are staying healthy and safe. I hope things are looking up as we begin this new year. I'm filled with optimism and hope and excitement for all that's to come. And let's start the year off with a great conversation with a great actor and filmmaker and writer. He's one of those multi-hyphenates that I would hate if he wasn't so charming and nice and self-deprecating. Here's my conversation with Bo Burnham. Bo Burnham, welcome to the Happy, Sad, Confused podcast. We were just saying we last saw each other in the before time when everything was good. What happened,
Bo? Well, we last saw each other in the sort of happy of the version of that, and it's
now and we're in sad and confused.
Yeah, it's sad and confused. I like gentle euphemisms for I think what's going on right now. You might need to add a few more slashes. It might have to be happy, sad, confused.
Totally fucked up and
depersonalized, dead, reborn, dead again.
I will take this 40 minutes of distraction with you, though. Hopefully we'll cheer each other up a little bit amidst this hellfire. I'm curious, what was this year supposed to be for you, and what did it turn out to be?
Well, you know what? Okay, this is a good example. I was supposed to turn 30. And I did, but I was
going to say, it was bad, but they didn't destroy your birthday too, did they?
I was always like, I never have birthday. I hadn't had a birthday party since I was like 15. And people always be like, you have a birthday. And I was like, I'll have it when I'm 30 and we'll all do something. Aww. And then it was really sad. Yeah. It's silly to talk about obviously all of what's happened in the context of my stupid,
sure,
like, you know, privileged life. Like I'm having it better than most other people.
Yeah.
Or most, well, other than the, you know, my chemical predisposition to not be able to experience joy. But
that's why we're on the phone together, because we share this. Well, I was going to say, I mean, you've been very open in talking about how you've dealt with anxiety over the years. And I'm curious, like, how have you coped in the most collectively stressful year in modern history? Like, what have your coping mechanisms been?
You know, it's been, I don't know, it's been, I think I went through the period that other, you know, people anxious, people with whatever, mental health issues. I know people had said like, well, when the world really felt like it was ending, I actually felt great, because like, it's like, I'm always worried that the world's going to, I'm always worried that things are going to be bad. So when things really are bad, I kind of have like this sense of calm. Yeah. And I had that a little bit, but then it kind of kept going and. I mean, it's hard for everybody. I mean, but I take solace in the fact that, but also I'm sad about the fact that every single person I talk to seems to be in a very particular crisis.
Yeah.
Like it's, and like, we're not all in the same crisis. Like my close, like everyone's kind of going through something very specific during this time. And like, we're kind of all, you maybe just united by the fact that we're all going through our own thing, but it's like, it is a deeply, like, for many people, it's an actually it's a time where they're struggling physically or with their health, or I mean, I'm not having to struggle economically, which is the biggest thing that is affecting most people.
Yeah.
But it's also just like a very psychic time. It's a very, I found it to be very interior psych, and that's tough for me. I mean, that's just like, that's not totally easy to deal with, because I'm just like, I'm the guy that, you know, is already kind of shut in his head. And now that I'm like encouraged by the government to be in my own head, that feels like not the ideal. I like, it was just, even this year, I was like, you know, I need to go out more. I need to engage with the world more. I need to like be outside. And then, so there's just a kind of a sick irony to all of that.
Well, and then there was all the like the expectations that different people brought to the year in terms of like, this is the year to kind of get to the projects I never got to, or like self-improve and whatever. And for me, it's like, we're all just trying to survive this year. 2020, chalk it up as just like the year to just make it out alive and hopefully make it out with your loved ones alive. Let's not put this extra,
you know, weight on her shoulders to also like get to the screenplay you always wanted to write. Like if you do, great, God bless. But this is a once in a generation moment.
And hopefully like this moment really also like kind of breaks down the sort of like puritanical individualism of our culture, of just like that mindset where we're all just trying to make our own thing. Mm. And we're all just trying to, you know, better ourselves and better our own careers. Right. Like that's how we get in a position where this happens, where things go wrong and we realize like, oh, there's no social safety net. There's no sense of community. There's no sense of like, we take care of each other. I mean, this moment more than anything hasn't proved that like what this moment doesn't need right now is more screenplays. It means, it needs like
caring about each other and
more communal,
out for each other. Exactly.
Yeah. Health services and providing for people so that, you know, I don't know. It's just like, so it's all, and also that has happened this year, which is nice to see. It's like a real, I think, social awakening towards like, you know, some sort of common interests.
No, totally. Your dog agrees.
Yes.
like, you go, Bo. So I'm curious, you know, going to the more superfluous, kind of silly, but important career stuff, which is partially what we're here to talk about. I mean, you know, I first started to talk to you a couple of years back when eighth grade was just everywhere. And I'm curious, you know, now you've got Promising Young Woman where you're starring alongside Carey Mulligan. At the end of the eighth grade saga, the long road that was, and it was a glorious kind of road for you, when you put the tux in the closet for the final time, did you have a clear idea of like what was next, of what you wanted to prioritize, what you wanted to be, what you wanted to pursue?
No, not really. And I've always kind of had like a weird just kind of impulse to like start all over all the time. I even had kind of convinced myself, like after eighth grade, I'm like, okay, I'm a filmmaker now. You know what I mean? And then I kind of go like, I don't know. Maybe I'm not. I don't really quite know. I just get not bored. That sounds like fucking so annoying. But I just get kind of antsy or I get very engaged by doing new things. That's like, that is what I get excited by is trying something that I haven't really done. So I didn't quite know, you know, I had signed up to like write these songs for the Sesame Street movie because it felt like, oh, that's something that's like, I really have to challenge myself. I haven't done that. And then the idea of acting was really exciting because like, I haven't really, to really just like give myself to someone else's vision, like Emerald's vision and just try to act. But eighth grade was also like very, very special and for me and is like, I'm definitely not someone that's like, I mean, it would have been great. I had like, you know, all this momentum that's like in the industry doesn't exist for very long. And in you know, independent film, like, where I could have, you know, got another movie going and attached stars or whatever, who cares? But like, it just felt like, no, that movie worked because it kind of was a story. I felt like I just absolutely had to tell. And there's kind of a painful part of the creative process for me where it's like, you kind of just have to be patient. And like, you, for me, I have to wait until it's like an idea that is so, so important to me and so, so meaningful to me that I will take a year and a half or 2 years to make it, you know, as opposed to, you know, like after eighth grade, people wanted me to do that, oh, direct this thing with these kids or whatever. And it's like,
yeah, you suddenly get into kind of like that every 2 year directing maybe someone else's material that, sure, you connect with them on some level, but that's a different path. And maybe your path is once every 5 or 6 years, when the muse strikes, you get the project that you feel so passionate about, you can't do anything else. And maybe
I don't really feel like some great functional director. I probably am not like a great hired guy. Like I think like if eighth grade worked, the reason it worked was because of how invested I was in it and passionately about it. I'm passionate about it. I was. So it's like, and it's just kind of the only way I can work. It's like the only way I can really work, or not really the only way, but like, it's like this weird thing with career stuff where it's like, you're always looking forward. You're always trying to build and get bigger and make a bigger thing or make, and it's like, and I could try to be like, okay, eighth grade was a small movie, very small budget. And it's like, oh, I could try to make a bigger one next. And it's like, but at a certain point I have to look around and go like, wait, I've kind of arrived at the place where I wanted to be at, which is I can kind of in theory do what I want next. So let's just do that as opposed to, I don't know, still trying to build a moment. Like the idea of,
What are you building towards when like you've already made something that you personally love and others love? Like that's the aspiration. If you can make five more, if you can make one more of those, if you don't make another one of those, that's great. Like, I mean, you've already kind of done.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah. And I find like momentum, career momentum to be stifling. Don't actually like it. And like, I think I best operate from a place of like having something to prove. That's what I always kind of want to feel like. Like when I made all my specials, even when I was doing stand-up, it was like, oh my God, I was so embarrassed by the material I made when I was 16. So I had to make it when I was 19. And then when I was 23, I was like, I'm so embarrassed by that comedy was so bad when I was 19. And then when eighth grade came around, it was like, all right, everyone knows me as this stupid, like musical YouTube guy or like, I have to make this movie to like be substantial. And then that worked and it's like, okay, yeah. So I don't really want to be like I don't really want to be like an established guy or anything. I don't think that I'd work well from there.
Well, yeah. And the next kind of mountain to climb, I guess, and challenge was to establish yourself more in the acting space. And, you know, to your credit, I mean, Promising Young Woman is truly one of, if not my favorite movies of the year. And you more than hold your own against arguably the best, you know, actor in the business, Carey Mulligan.
Oh, that's nice. Well, it's funny because, you know, it's so funny. So with acting, I really am not, I mean, I'm not trying to become anything, you know, I don't like that. What's nice is that I'm less like personally invested in acting. So it can just be I can kind of engage with it in a slightly fun and more confident way than the other stuff because it isn't as loaded with me. Like, honestly, like if I did this movie and, you know, everyone just thought like, Jesus, what the hell is he doing on screen? Like it would have been embarrassing, but it would have been like, all right, okay, I'll go do something else. You know what I mean? So it's like, I'm lucky to not have to, you know, fully rely on my acting career as my future, because I don't think I would have one if that was my future. But
I can get the worst feeling to feel like you don't want to be in a scene and disappoint the director.
Exactly.
So I mean, did you get to a place pretty early on where you felt like you had a place at the table and could hold your own against Carrie and not disappoint yourself and others?
Well, not really. No. I mean, well, the good thing is at least the scenes kind of integrated that feeling pretty easily because the scenes are just about like me trying to constantly impress her and being worried that I'm not impressing her. So like I could kind of like channel all of what was actually going through my head into the scenes. But it was very funny just though to go from like having directed a bunch of actors, you know, work with them to then being an actor and being like, oh my God, I am a needy actor that needs to like be I was just like, I never was on the set thinking of myself as a director. I was never thinking of anything other than thinking like, oh my God, if I was dealing with myself and like if I had an actor that was being like I'm being, I'd be like, dude, just shut up and do it. And you know, just like
so were you asking after a take, like was that good or are you
looking I'm just like in my own head and it's just like funny to be like, okay, like this gives me at least empathy for actors that go crazy. Like I totally get why actors are insane. Like of course, you know, big movie stars like, yeah, they're overpaid, they're over, but it's like there is something like psychically violating and insane about being in front of a camera. It's just like the eye of God and the devil staring at you, like immortalizing you and taking your soul. It is just like it's just naked in a film. It's naked in a way that, you know, like if you make a film, it's like, oh, they didn't like my film, okay. But if like when people don't like your acting, it's like they didn't like your face and kind of just how you were, which is like that's kind of brutal,
the ultimate rejection. Not to mention you had some challenging stuff in this. You had to do the artful dance of montage acting.
Oh my God, exactly, just real Eisenstein shit.
has Paris Hilton's Stars Are Blind gotten a bump yet on the charts? Do we know
I hope so. I mean, I hope we get like a vinyl like re-release release or something, but I think it's a pretty, I always said, like, it's like the lyric, like Stars Are Blind, is like some chilling, like T.S. Eliot shit. Like it really is like, wow. And I think the movie kind of reclaims that aesthetic, kind of reclaims like,
yeah,
this like aesthetic that people dismiss as girly and thin and decorative is actually kind of meaningful and deep if you actually listen to it. I mean, a lot of that kind of pop music, when you actually listen to the lyrics, you're like, oh, this is actually kind of more deep and stark than I thought it was.
The film, I mean, I guess getting back to Sundance when it first screened, and as more people have seen it, I wouldn't say it's like polarizing, but certainly there have been some, along some gender lines, some differences of how people are interpreting it. And to me, it feels a little silly. It's like if you're a dude in 2020 and you don't recognize that our gender has performed rampant toxicity since the beginning of time, then maybe you need a reality check.
But if the film wasn't divisive, I think it wouldn't be, then it just means it's not actually engaging with what's going on.
No,
because like
fair.
What's yeah. going on is divisive. So I would hope that, you know, it's tapping into that conversation.
Does the material, reading a script, performing this kind of material, make you kind of reassess your own toxicity, your own, and we've all, you know, been there to various degrees?
Well, definitely. I mean, and that was, yeah, definitely. And it's, I think the important thing the movie does is like cast a very wide net in terms of like showing the different levels of culpability and like how actually gradient it is, that it really fades all the way to the littlest possible thing, that it isn't like some clear line in the sand where these guys are bad and these guys are good. And like, if you self-identify as a good guy, you're probably the first one that should self-examine.
Right.
Because like, you're the one that seems, that thinks you're above criticism. So yeah, I mean, it's like, it did. And like, and like, there were things in the script with the other guys that like resonated with me. I was like, oh my God, like recognizing myself, like Christopher Mintz-Plasse, like talking about Consider the Lobster. I'm like, oh Jesus, you know what I mean? Like I can like totally identify with all of that. And that's what's fun and funny about the script too, is that it like, it really does kind of, I think, give an accurate portrayal of the, it's not just certain type of men. It's not like, it's the way men are when they're trying to impress women. That's what's funny, is that it's not like, it's like, it really exposes like the performance of like heterosexual male courtship as very ridiculous and like goofy and funny until it's not, until it's very not. So, yeah, I mean, yes.
It's also interesting to me that like, you know, most of the men in this film are reckoning or being forced to reckon with these kind of, you know, mistakes of various degrees in their past. And not to equate your life, because certainly you haven't done the things that the guys in this one have done, but you've been very open. And even in this conversation of sort of like, reckoning with the early material of your career, and like from the beginning, like going back, like I listened back to your like Marc Maron conversation, which was like you were like 21 or something at the time, or even then you were apologizing for stuff doing like at 17. So it's like that's in your DNA. This is like right up your alley.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, it was kind of just a product of the way I started, which is just like, you know, I started at 16, and then so like, the person you are at 16, 19, 21, 25, you know? So it's like this conversation that's really kind of peaked these last couple of years about like, whatever it means, whatever you call it, cancellation, whatever, right. Accountability, whatever that is. Like, I think it's a thing that younger people my age and younger really have been wrestling with for a while, which is that because like our lives and like the roadmap to the person we currently are is just accessible online.
Right.
And it's like an embarrassing roadmap for most of us. I know for me, it really is like, I wish I could have some like spotless oeuvre that just was just like totally self-contained and like told a coherent, you know, moral story, but it just isn't. I mean, I was like a 17-year-old kid in 2007 trying to be funny at like the peak of like Family Guy. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like pretty embarrassing shit.
And not to mention the complication that's what earned you fame. That's what got you where you were, that material.
Exactly. Is that it actually worked. But I always knew, even when I was young, even when I was 16, I knew that like, I'm not as good as I can be. Like the whole point, like I know I'm going to be better at this. So even though this is working, like I have to get better. Like I want to get, I don't know what I'm really doing yet. And right. That's sort of been like my whole life has sort of just been like creatively like putting stuff out to be like, no, sorry for everything I said before. Actually, I mean this. Sorry for everything. Actually, I mean that. And it's like, the hope is that we can allow for that change, one, but that also it doesn't, but also that when people ask for that change, people don't get so defensive, because it's like comedians, especially, I think it happens with older comedians. They're just so defensive about this stuff and like so defensive about re-examining their previous work. And it's just like, what, I mean, like things are changing. In comedy ages like milk, it just does. It just right. like you watch like a comedy from the 90s, you're like, Jesus Christ. Like you go like, wow, I did not realize how actually insane some of this was. So
should I not go back and watch your work in Hall Pass? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I don't remember. I might have been good in that. I was a bartender at 18. Like, I think I gave a shot to Owen Wilson. That's what I did. But yeah, I never really thought about that in terms of that this movie kind of deals with that too. But yeah, it is, you're right. It is about something even bigger than just the topic of sexual assault, but just like the way in which we all sort of contend with our past.
Yeah.
And it's going to get increasingly difficult going forward, just because now as we go forward, just like what's going to happen in 30 years when the people running for president, we have everything they've said since they were 15 or,
truly.
You know what I mean? It's like, we're going to have to figure out how to move forward.
I have a small confession to make to Bo. The first time I kind of encountered your work or knew of you, like, part of my gig for many years has been working for MTV for a long while. And you had an MTV show back in the day.
Hell yeah.
And I had the instinctual, you know, again, maybe self-hating kind of reaction of hating anybody that had an MTV show, because you can, I can't respect anybody that actually works for MTV. And I say that as somebody that works for MTV. Did you have the same kind of, I don't know, what was your experience at MTV like? Because that was kind of a self-reflexive show dealing with what some of the issues that you were dealing with. Did you feel like you were able to kind of create what you wanted, or were you put through the meat grinder? What was your...
Part of it was like, hey, I'm going to go into like, you know, pardon the term. I mean, it's a whole different regime, so no one will care. But yeah, I was like, I'm going to go into the belly of the beast and talk about all these issues about like kids and the relationship to fame, my age, you know, people my age, the relationship to attention and fame. And then I got in and I was like, oh shit, I'm in the belly of the beast. What am I doing in here? Like, it stinks. But you know, we had some nice executives that actually really did enjoy and really understood the show. And what stuck is that there was just a complete regime change when we finished the show,
right?
And just new people came in, and that thing just happened where they didn't really understand the show. It wasn't theirs, and so they kind of just dumped it on a Saturday. And that's like, that's fine. I mean, it was fine. I really hold no animosity towards anyone there, and they're just doing their job. And you know, it's like, yeah. There's no criticism I have of MTV that doesn't apply to basically every form of media in existence. You know,
exactly. MTV in that regard. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God. Like the damage being done to all of us by just like media. And I don't mean like media, like I'm some like, you know, MAGA person talking about like, I mean every form of media. I mean like every picture on the wall, every advertisement in the street, just like this thing that we've all just been, at least I have been marinating in for 30 years of my life, just images and videos and pictures. It's just like the totality of that damage that is being done just to like the psychic, just like my subjective experience of the world that I'm just sort of kind of waking to. That is, I think, what all my stuff is kind of.
Yeah.
Trying to see from different angles is like what is this doing to us, and it all kind of becomes inward facing, because it's, of course, I'm making media about sort of my fraught relationship with it, so that's sort of and I think Promising a Woman is about it in some ways, because Promising a Woman really does play with this idea of like movie tropes of like what have movies done in their representation of hookups, or in the representation of like a comedy where a drunk girl stumbles out of a bar, or a comedy where guys wake up to a dead stripper, you know? Yeah, like that. Yeah. Like all, like the movie really examines, like, which I believe firmly that like the representation of things in film really do inform the way they play out in real life. That the first time I went to a college party, I thought, oh man, this is like Animal House. You know what I mean? So
sure.
The things that were funny in that movie, I then think are permissible in that frat house. Like, oh, that guy's not being an asshole to that girl. He's being John Belushi. He's being fun.
Right. Let's go back to the good old days before media saturation turned all of our minds and souls into toxic wastelands. Let's talk about the movies.
We're talking about the Gutenberg press. We're talking about back in the 15th century.
Yeah, exactly.
pre-Gutenberg. That's when it was.
I'm so in it that I was thinking Steve Gutenberg at first. So I got really confused.
That's hilarious, Steve.
Before Police Academy? There was something before then? But I did ask you for a comfort movie because I've been asking most of my guests for this crazy times. And I'm just curious, before we get to your selection, tell me sort of like where your movie sensibilities were as a kid. What were your guys? Who were your girls? Who were you fascinated by? What were you the posters?
Well, honestly, like I was not like raised. My father just watched Con Air and Armageddon every day, like genuinely. So that's like sort of the cultural atmosphere that I was raised in. So it was like a lot of like, I mean, it was like genuine, like Dumb and Dumber. I mean, like Jim Carrey, like, oh, you know, I mean, I love Jim Carrey as a kid. I love Sandler. So it's just like a lot of comedies, Tommy Boy. I mean, that's like if I'm being real honest, like that's why I was a kid. It wasn't until I saw like, I think like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was the first movie I saw that made me go like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, what is this thing with these people acting like this? And it like, it felt so alive in a way that was just like stunning to me. But as a kid, it was very, very basic. Like right. I loved like Men in Black and Independence. Like I love Will Smith. I think he was the coolest person in the world. Like, and I think I cherish that. I cherish the fact that like, I grew up just with very basic, normal sort of cultural interests. Because like even comedy, like stand-up, I like stand-up comedy as a form because it is it's meant to be like a medium of the people. You know what I mean? Really, it's meant to like communicate to like real people. That's like, I do want to do that. I do want to like, you know, I'm not just trying to make like, you know, indecipherable stuff for like 12 really cool people.
You're not doing New Yorker cartoons necessarily.
Yeah, and it's not because like, I mean, I wish I could do that. I mean, I don't think I'm like skilled or smart enough to do that, but it's like, I enjoy, part of me, like I want to make stuff that my brother loves and my sister loves and, you know, I really value my connection to normal sort of cultural interests. The British Office is probably the most formative actual thing for me in some ways,
right.
Even though it's a TV show. Like, I know people overstate that, but I watched that like once a year. And that probably had like the biggest effect on even eighth grade was that movie, just that style of performance. That sort of, the thing that's gotten lost, I think, in all the adaptations of the British Office and all of its forms in America, like, and not just The Office, but every form is just like, yeah, just the particular relationship of people to the way a camera changes a room.
Right.
Really specifically the way a camera changes people, which is like, that to me is like one of the central questions that we have to, and the more we've forgotten about cameras and rooms, the more we need to examine that question, the more normalized they've become.
It also, like the film you chose, revels in discomfort. In the best possible way. So on the movie side, you didn't go with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, as comforting as Milos Forman's work can be. You went with one of Christopher Guest's best. What was your pick?
I went with Best in Show, which is so funny. I didn't even realize until this conversation that like, oh, right. Like Jennifer Coolidge is in Promising a Woman. Like I didn't even think of the connection of, cause I mean, Jennifer's like absolutely one of the highlights of that movie and one of the highlights of Promising Woman. I think she's brilliant in it.
Yeah.
But like, well, it's funny. Best in Show is similar to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in just being like as robust and impenetrable an ensemble as is like possible.
Right.
Like just actually how across the board incredible everyone is in it is like, yeah, just truly kind of mind blowing.
Do you remember when or how you first kind of saw it or became obsessed with
so
it?
I first saw it up in like my grandmother's like little, she lives in like a little cabin in Maine. I'm from Massachusetts, so my mother's side of the family is up in Maine. And I went up there, it must have been around when it came out. So I was like 10 or 11.
Right.
And there was a VHS of it, and me and my cousin watched it. And I just thought, I just never, ever seen anything that funny in my entire life. And there's like with Best in Show, like, it was similar around when I watched The British Office of waking up to that. But like, there are sort of levels of that comedy that you kind of only get on repeated viewings. Like, obviously the first time you watch it, it's like Fred Willard is what you're really, really, because he's just like, it's also unbelievable of like dramatically, like how late into that film he shows up, to show up that late into a film that is already that good and somehow steal the movie is so impressive. But yeah, I mean, I just watched it really recently. Like Parker Posey is unbelievable. Catherine O'Hara is unbelievable. Obviously Eugene Levy. And just recently I was really particularly marveling when I saw it at Catherine O'Hara, of her in that film.
Yeah.
He's across the board just so one. I'm so glad. I haven't watched Schitt's Creek, but I'm it's like really amazing to see her kind of, and Eugene kind of really get like a rousing cultural response, like the overdue, like
totally
coronation culturally that they deserve, because they are just, you know, I mean, like iconic, all-time great comedic performers that's like a thing that's really dying out. Like, we don't have those performers anymore. And it's another thing, like, we don't have comedy, really substantial, like straight up comedies anymore. No. And this is the conversation I have with everybody all the time. Like, everything's a dramedy. Even eighth grade, people were like, I'm like, eighth grade's not a comedy. Like, I mean, it's funny, there's funny moments, but like, trust me, if I try to make a funny movie, it'll be funnier than eighth grade. It'll be funnier. I'm like, come on, eighth grade. Like, I won't. If I try to make a funny movie, it's not going to like be that serious as eighth grade was. Like,
no, it's true that there aren't the Christopher Guest movies, even the Farrelly brothers back in the day.
Totally.
Mel Brooks. I mean,
even McKay's stuff of like Step Brothers.
We lost McKay now. McKay's gone to dramedy. I love his new stuff, but like I mean, that's a guy that can work on that level just of absurdity that is just genius.
I know, and you know what? And it's why it's honestly like, you know, like, I'm saying Sandler's holding it down. Like, you watch those Sandler movies, it's like, you know what? These movies are trying to be funny. They are just trying to be funny. And like, I watched Hubie Halloween and I was laughing. I was really laughing. I was like, it's just like, it's so refreshing to see something that is really just trying to make you laugh.
Right.
Because like, rather than like also trying to do all this other stuff, it's like, gosh, like, and that's what's, I mean, like Best in Show is just so, and it's amazing because you can also, it can also be read politically, it can be read as this like hilarious indictment of just like brain dead white people that are so like insulated, they like from the like pain of the world, that they're just like worried about competing their own like purebred dogs. It's like, it is so, all there's also, it is like biting and smart in a way that it never has to stay, but right. It's just like it is such a just a breezy, funny comfort, and it's movies like that with that type of performance that is like kind of just existing on the edge of spontaneous and improvised, that I feel like I can watch multiple times because there's just so much subtlety to enjoy. You know, a pick that I was almost going to say, am I just talking?
No, this is good.
Okay. I almost wanted, it was hilariously, I wanted to almost put Let Them All Talk as my comfort pick, even though it came out 2 weeks ago, because it's like the first movie that I've watched, like I watched it twice in like a day, and I haven't done that in a long, long time. And that movie, similar, is just like, there's a certain warmth to a type of performance for me. That is spontaneous, that feels spontaneous. It's something I really tried to get in eighth grade, where it's like, it's a type of performance you can never get twice. You can never get that type of line read twice. And it's just like, it's on the edge of falling apart at any moment. That is just like, really beautiful to me, because the more we have cameras in our face 24/7, the more everyone's on Instagram or Twitter or TikTok, so trying to present themselves, the more like, it's like TikTok. Like when you see TikTok and you realize like, oh, the stuff that goes viral there are these like weird human moments that kids capture. Like they captured their mother like tripping and spilling a dinner all over the place, or like those moments that go viral on Instagram and Twitter and TikTok, which are these like little, because the fact that everyone's filming stuff all the time, they capture these little human moments that could never have happened, of like, I don't know, some raccoon standing on the porch, like knocking on the glass or something. It's like,
right. Well, and the funny thing you mentioned, I mean, for Let Them All Talk, which is coincidentally also on HBO Max, guys, you're selling HBO Max subscriptions today, Bo, Best in Show's on there too.
Oh, but yeah. They
both were approached in a similar way. And that they both are very heavily improvised films. I mean, Best in Show, infamously, the story is that there's the 16-page kind of outline for that film. Soderbergh was actually just on the podcast. I was talking to him about Let Them All Talk as well. And similarly, he had an outline essentially and had a direction for his actors. You know, as you well know, you know, having been even a part of the Apatow world, like there's that been that push and pull in the last 15, 20 years between like improv and script, and like maybe leaning maybe too heavily on improv
That's the thing is, it's a certain type of improv. I mean, it's leave to maybe lean too heavily. It's just, I don't like directionless improv where it feels like you're riffing, trying to find like a joke rather than like, Let Them All Talk. They are always riffing in character on
and
dynamic.
Serving that story. Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. And the story becomes like the really subtextual relationship between people where one is more successful or has more money or is better off, or like this, how the subtext of people's relationships plays in the stuff that you would never think to write. There are so many moments in Let Them All Talk that are like these human counterintuitive moments that you would never ever write in a script because it wouldn't read right. But then when someone does it, it's like that incredible moment in the beginning of Let Them All Talk, when the first scene of Lucas Hedges, and he's at the billiard table, he's playing pool with his friends, and he does like a weird, like, ha! He does like a scream to his friends that like, it may have been Lucas just like screwing up a line or right. Just like, but it's just, it's like that just absolutely like, that type of like lightning moment that only can happen spontaneously. And I wish that like, the word improv wasn't such a dirty word, because I feel like people say that. They say a movie's improv and then they feel like, oh, well, it's nothing. And like, I feel like the actors in Let Them All Talk are not getting credit because people think they're acting or they're improvising, so it's easy. And it's like, no, it's not. It's not like that. It's way more difficult than that to be open and human in that way on screen. So I wish that performances that used improv were given more credit. And it's not like Meryl Streep improvised her way onto a boat. It wasn't, she was like, hey, let's go to that cruise ship. And they were like, okay, I guess we're doing
so. Everyone like, follow Meryl.
But yeah, it's like, I just think, yeah. So I almost wish they didn't tell everyone it was improvised, because I feel like people would have given the performances way more.
Right.
Wouldn't have given them their due if they didn't, you know, get clouded by that dirty word.
Where are you at right now in terms of your attitude about performing, whether it's acting or stand-up? Is stand-up even in your mind at all, or to you, is that a closed chapter in your life?
No, it's not closed. I mean, well, there's the logistic closing to it.
Well, sure.
For sure. But no, I mean, I'm open to it. I mean, it's all about just, for me, like, it's motivated by wanting to say something, and then like, where's the best place to say this?
Right.
And there certainly is, you know, something that I was maybe more terrified of now that it's really been taken away from me, has become, you know, maybe appealing again. But right. Yeah, it's difficult. I don't know. It's a strange time, and you know, a strange way to engage with the world. It's also, it's very tough to offer when it feels just like the world is just drowning in opinion and drowning in commentary, to feel right. Like you're going to be additive when it feels like the most additive thing would actually be subtracting from it in some sort of way.
Well, so, it does feel like, frankly, like since eighth grade, like you're not really on social media at all. It's like, I searched Deadline. It's not like there are like four different Bo Burnham stories. You're kind of laying low and doing your thing. And there's nothing wrong with that, except it's just like, it's not the norm in the industry, where people sometimes like kind of feel this impulse to be seen constantly, to be, even in a year where no one's actually out and about, they're finding ways to TikTok or Instagram or make themselves feel relevant. And it's clearly, to your credit, I don't think you have that inner, thirst.
I have thirst. I mean, I'm definitely a thirsty person, but it just like, I mean, I started too young. So I've got some
of that out of your system a little earlier than most.
Or not even that. It's just that I've been around too long. I realize that. Like, I've been around too long for half of my life now in some way. And I realized that, like, I would understand anyone at any point getting tired of me. So I feel like I only want to engage with the world when I have something to really put out there. Like, I really think we need to like talk more about like our cultural emissions, not just our physical emissions. And it's like, I'm not really gonna, you're only gonna hear from me when I have something that I've really, really worked very hard on and think is worthy of your attention. I mean, the thing that I just think is really, really strange when I see like comedians or whatever, it's like, just like on Twitter commenting on every single thing that happens every day. Right. And then it's like, and then you want to put out a special, or then you want to put out a, it's like, well, who cares? Like, it's just like, who cares? So I've been hearing from you this entire time. It's strange. It's also like, I really think the only way for me to make stuff is in silence. I can't like, I have to.
You don't need everybody as a sounding board, everybody weighing in on your Sesame Street development deal.
Yeah, exactly. Or just going like, trying out an idea here, I get the impulse. I get the impulse. It's just, I don't know. Well, I also think at a certain age, it's like, all right, guys, like, cool off. We're too old to be doing this. Like, let the kids have the internet now. Like, they should be the ones like making all the stuff. I think like,
right.
At a certain point, I just feel like, I'm getting to the age where it's just like, I work and I present stuff. I'm not like out there, spinning around every day.
Well, it must be a relief in some ways, having turned 30, that like, as somebody that's been like the narrative of your life has always been about how young he was, how young he is.
Yeah, exactly.
You're a legit adult. Like,
yeah, exactly. And it's over. Yeah, it's like, exactly. It's like, it's not impressive anymore.
It's not exactly.
It's like, it is. It's like a total relief to just be like, okay, now I can just, and I've always wanted to do that. I mean, that's what I actually want to do. I'd rather just be the guy that pops up every 2 years and releases something. And also like, I am genuinely very happy with my level of recognition, which is very minimal, and would not want any more of it. Like, I don't want to be any more known than I am, which I know is very stupid, as I'm like promoting a film that I'm in. But I just mean like, that is not something I need to, I feel like I've built enough whatever that I can like justify making my next thing, and that's all I really care about. It's just the ability to make things.
And genuinely, it's
just like, what does engaging with the cult, what does engaging on Twitter, all that stuff do, other than just like, I don't know what it does for me.
It also
makes me sick to my stomach. Like, if I go on Twitter, it makes me want to, yeah.
Well, you're nothing if not an engaging set of paradoxes, Bo Burnham. It's part of why I always enjoy chatting with you.
I appreciate it. And it's also, it's important for me to like, I want to kind of, in the corniest way, give like a roadmap to, or a potential version of a roadmap to younger people.
Right.
Going up. Because I would go like, man, if I was young trying to make stuff, I would be so confused. And I want to tell young people, like, it's not just about self-promotion. It isn't just about having to be out there all the time selling yourself. Like, you also can take the time to just work and not worry about just, I don't know. I wouldn't know how to start now. I feel very guilt. I feel bad for people coming up now.
Well, in that case, then I'm happy to say that maybe it'll be 2 years before we catch up again. You can suffer and create your art in silence and not feel the horrors of Twitter like I do, because I'm a fool. But I do look forward to catching
up. But the thing is, truly, you're doing the right thing. I mean, it's like there should be people like you. There should be commentators. There should be that. It's just like should. It's just like it's not everyone's job to do your job. That's my point. It's like for a particular type of people that do your job. It shouldn't be the thing everyone does.
Right. Fair enough. Well, happy to say that Promising Young Woman has brought us together not once but twice in this insane year. Congratulations on it, man. Honestly, it is one of the best films I've seen in quite some time, and you're excellent in it. And I hope everybody checks it out. And I hope we can keep talking as the years go by. I'm excited. I love your career in that, you know, as you openly have said throughout, like, you're not going to be in stasis, certainly. You're always going to be mixing it up and trying stuff. And that's an exciting path to be on. So thanks for your time, dude. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Josh. Well, I hope we talk soon.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.
3 To your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.